Welcome to My Hinterland, what we do when we're not doing what we do, in which I get to ask people about their lives, about what they do, and what they do when they want to step out of that life and be or go somewhere else. My name's Jeremy Harmer, and I hope you'll enjoy listening to these conversations as much as I've enjoyed taking part in them. So my guest today is Martin West. He's the music director of the San Francisco Ballet, amongst his other musical posts, and we'll talk about that in a minute. This conversation is going to be a great pleasure for me because I haven't actually seen Martin for many years now. We've just found out how long ago it was. But I knew him when he was a much younger man, conducting an amateur orchestra that I played in and still play in. So, Martin, there's a lot to talk about. Welcome.
Thanks very much. It's been great to see you again, Jeremy.
It's lovely to see you again.
Half my life ago, nearly, actually.
This may sound like a silly question, but you are the music director of one of the world's great ballet companies. What do you do?
That's a really good question. I actually have two titles in my job, which helps to explain it. But my job title is music director and principal conductor. So there is definitely two sides of the equation. Perhaps the easiest to explain is as principal conductor. For that, I conduct most of the performances of the orchestra with the dancers, and I go on tour with them when they go, and we'll use other orchestras. So my job is to perform. People train to be in their art forms and really in silos. No one knows about dance who's a musician, and no one who's a dancer really knows about music. I mean, it's not quite as obvious as that, but very much it's totally different types of training. And the great thing about being a conductor for ballet is being the bridge between the two and bringing them both together. So that's the most high profile thing I do, I guess, as a ballet conductor. The music director side is more of a, I wouldn't say administration, but I have an orchestra to run. I have an extremely talented and well thought of orchestra, which I'm in charge of. I have to make sure that the people we hire are of the right caliber, people who come to conduct the orchestra who are not me, of the highest caliber, and who can work with all the dancers and the people and the staff here. I have to make sure that when the artistic director comes up with, and now we have a new director, her program, I have to be able to deliver on all the music that is required, whether it be something that is just standard rep, which is easy to deal with, or it's a brand new commission with a composer who has some crazy ideas, and I have to, you know, crazy good, crazy bad, we have to filter them out and make sure that we're planning ahead for the future. As music director, I have to make sure that the orchestra is as high profile as it can be, just for their sake, and organize recordings for them and things like that. So,
what makes you good at it, or if you don't want to say that, what do you need to be good at? Let's start with the conducting, for example. What is it you need to be able to do and make happen as a conductor?
Okay, well, Well, that's a good question. Do you mean as a conductor or for ballet conductor?
As a conductor, as a ballet conductor.
Because if you take the Venn diagram of conducting, right, a conductor has to be able to coalesce a number of talented musicians into one group and make them all play with the same goal. And so just as a pianist has 10 fingers and his goal is to make all those 10 fingers work together to make a piece of music, the orchestra has to be able to play in the same way. You can have an incredibly talented orchestra playing all different ways, and it doesn't sound good. So the job of the conductor is to really coalesce that. When you then take that Venn diagram of conductors, within that then, my job is to coordinate what happens on stage with the orchestra. I need to be able to provide music so that the dancers can dance. And I said that quite carefully. I don't mean I follow the dance. I don't mean I slavishly do everything they ask. I don't, that's enough don'ts. I do, make sure that the music, I try to make sure that the music they're listening to as dancers is absolutely the best quality music we can possibly provide. Because I've always said, we have a world-class ballet troupe here, and they deserve to have world-class music. I don't think you can have world-class ballet without having both. And then beyond that, my job is to work with what the dancers have to do. So the dancers are told the choreography and what moves they have to do by the choreographer. So in some ways, I'm a conduit between the choreographer and the dancers to allow them to be able to fulfill what they need to do, what the choreographer has in mind to go with the music, without spoiling the music, but actually enhancing the music. So if it all works well, as Balanchine very famously said, you should be able to see, in the dances, you should be able to see the music, and in the pit, you should be able to hear the dance. And when it works, it's an extraordinary experience. So
I imagine, we won't go on about this forever, but I heard what you said about obviously you don't follow them and they don't follow you. There's a sort of meeting in the middle, but a live performance is a live performance, and stuff happens in live performances.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. Yeah.
Presumably you in particular, well, the dancers too, but you in particular have to be extremely responsive and somehow persuade the orchestra. To follow you when things are going a little bit.
No, absolutely. And then that's where I have to have the trust of the orchestra and the skill, my own conducting technique to be able to convey to the orchestra in split second what goes on. And as I've got older, I should say, I've got more experienced at navigating, how can I put it? Sometimes you see something happening on stage and you want to react to it because something has happened that isn't right. And obviously your brain says, action stations. But the orchestra, the equivalent of a little oil tanker downstairs, and you can't just turn them on a dime all the time. If you're in an old manual car, a little mini trying to go up the hill, you can't just suddenly decide you're going to go in fourth gear because you want to go faster. You have to go through the gears to get to the place you want to be. So there's always this sort of mental calculation going on in your head when your physicality of your body is more in tune with the dancers, because that's, I'm a moving artist like the dancers, and I have to kind of separate the head from the body and then amalgamate them as best I can.
Let's backtrack a bit. I know that San Francisco is your kind of home base, but I know you've also conducted English National Ballet and the Royal Ballet and the New York City Ballet and various other ballets and stuff like that. But how did you get into all this? Where are you from and who were your parents and what's your kind of background?
Long story short, I'm from Bolton near Manchester. I always have to say that because the Americans never know where Bolton is. But if you say near Manchester, they go, oh, right. So I'm from Bolton. My father was a language teacher, actually, and a very keen on music, but didn't play anything. My mother was a peripatetic music teacher. She taught for, first of all, in Halifax and then in Bury, next to Bolton. And then ended up in Tameside as a peripatetic music teacher, teaching all sorts of, mostly flute and clarinet, but teaching hundreds of kids throughout her career. So that was the inspiration for music. And I had two brothers who also played music, were older than me, and they were kind of inspirational. I not necessarily trying to follow in the footsteps, but it was kind of the obvious thing to do when they were good at things, and I would do the same sort of things. And I got into the National Youth Orchestra on the cello, I mean, to some extent on their back, which I felt very privileged to do. And
is that your only instrument, or do you play lots of others?
I played piano and cello were my two instruments.
How young were you when you got going on the cello?
I'll tell you this story because everybody likes this one. I first played in an orchestra when I was 4 years old on triangle. Because, as I say, my mum was, this is in the early days of the Bury Youth Orchestra, 1973, and rehearsals were on Friday night, and my dad was working still, and mum didn't have any babysitting, so I had to go and sit at the youth orchestra rehearsals while my brothers played, and the percussion teacher said, well, you know, don't waste him. We need some help in the percussion. Come and play triangle. So then that was my first experience. And that's, I actually can still picture it. I know I can still picture the gym, the hall that we used to rehearse in. And the piece was called Clouds, for what it's worth.
And you played your triangle in the right place and at the right time.
Well, my part went one and two and ping and two and it, on repeat. And I mean, that's it's kind of vivid memory. So it's probably actually one of my earliest memories somehow. Anyway, I digress. That was
it is a very good story. You're quite right.
And then I went to play. Then I started on the violin, and I did a couple of I don't know how long violin. And I think long story short, I was itching to get further along than the teacher was allowing me to, and my mum, not wanting to upset the teacher, then suggested that I might like to play the cello instead. And so I took over the cello that my brother had been playing on and started on the cello. So that was probably when I was about 5 or 6, I think. And I started playing piano when I was 5 as well, I think.
So pretty early. Was it were you kind of instantly?
No. It was very much, you know, I was a terrible practicer. I never did anything. I used to love playing in the ensembles. Like, I've always loved playing in, you know, the string group or whatever it was, that the level I was at the time. Piano I used to quite enjoy. But even then, I had times when I wouldn't practice. I even stopped lessons at one point when I was 8, 9, 10 or something like that for what seemed like a long time, but perhaps it wasn't. But
What else were you interested in as a schoolboy? What else did you like?
Stuff, you know, football, cricket. Dad was an avid cricket fan, so we used to go and watch Lancashire play cricket all the time. We used to play out all the time. We used to play cricket and soccer in the street all the time.
So there was that, and then there's all the music. But I'm right, aren't I, in thinking that you went to university, but you didn't study music at university, did you?
No, I did maths at Cambridge, actually, yeah. You know, I got to thank my brothers for that as well, because we were all quite clever, I guess. You know, and both my brothers went to Cambridge to do maths. And by the time it came to, you know, because you have to choose A-levels, right? You know, that in England, you choose pretty early what you're going to do. And I had no idea. I was interested in lots of things. I mean, my dad was a linguist, and I really enjoyed French and German, and I thought about doing that. And then kind of thought, well, there's no career there. Beg your pardon. and I thought about being a doctor, all these things. I thought, well, it takes a long time to become a doctor. That's 5 years of education, which is ironic because it took me 8 years before I left music college for my higher education. But that's, I couldn't decide anything. But I was really good at maths, like my brothers. And so it seemed that they'd done it, so it seemed like an easy thing to do. So I did that and got into Cambridge on that. But really, by the time I got to Cambridge, I think I'd started doing a little bit of conducting with my youth orchestra, and I'd already decided
I think the question is why and how, sort of thing, really.
How did I get into conducting? So I remember this is another very vivid memory of mine. As I said earlier, I was very lucky enough to get into the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain on the cello. And I just, you know, and obviously the standard of playing there and the standard of conducting people we had to conduct was much higher than I'd ever experienced before. And I remember sitting in a rehearsal with Vernon Handley, who ended up being my first teacher conducting, gave me a couple of lessons. I remember playing this piece of music, Rachmaninoff, over and over again. And we never practiced it. You know, I was always used to these conductors stopping, saying, no, okay, so you need to do this, you need to do that, let's do that, let's change this. And he didn't say very much. And after a while, I realized that we were playing it differently each time. And I realized that we were doing things that weren't written on the page. And why were we all doing a crescendo there when it wasn't written? And it just, this light bulb moment came, and I realized, oh my God, that he's making us do that. He's actually making us do that. And then I just got fascinated by him. He was an incredible guy. I mean, the way he talked about music and conducting was made me realize what he was trying to do, which was to play the orchestra. Like you play the piano, like I say, you know, that's why I always make that thing. It's an instrument. And your job is to play it with this little bit of white stick and have you do it? And I became fascinated by that. And I went back to my local youth orchestra after that, that youth orchestra course. I think I was 16 at the time. And I just said, I want to have a go at conducting. I want to have a go at conducting. And they all just laughed at me and said, don't be silly, don't be silly. And I just kept saying it. I don't know. And then eventually, and I can't remember exactly when it was, to be honest, the person who ran the string group said, okay, you can have a go, you know, and here's a 5-minute piece of music. This is, if you want to conduct that, you can. So I did, and it was great.
And it did the trick.
Well, I was probably rubbish, you know, I don't know, but I had a blast. I know, it was fantastic. It was amazing that, you know, to be able to make people do things without saying anything. I just thought it was fantastic.
So when you got to Cambridge, you got your maths degree, did you?
Yeah, hook or by crook, yeah.
But you spent, as I seem to remember in previous conversations, you spent most of your time musicking, didn't you?
So the first year was when you go to university, it was just, I did so much playing of the cello. Then. And then I applied for one of the conducting positions with CUMS, University Music Society. And I don't know how, but I got the position of one of the two conductors of CUMS 2, which is the second symphony orchestra, which is still pretty, you know, it's actually very talented. You imagine Cambridge is lots of really good ones. And that gave me kind of a bit of stature within the music world. In my second year, I then put on a concert, I guess, for all my friends to play. So I spent the entire first term of my second year getting all the, this is the days before email or anything. So if you actually wanted to have someone to play for, you had to go and knock on their door and ask them very nicely. So imagine cycling around Cambridge, because I wanted all the best players. Obviously, I didn't just want anybody. And so I got all my friends to come and play. We put on Shostakovich 5. And I remember, I think the concert was in about the 6th or 7th week of the term. And I said to my director of studies, are you going to come to my concert? He said, well, of course I am. I want to know why I haven't been doing any work all year. And so, you know, and so it began. So, you know, I used to do so much music in the first two terms, and I would go home at Easter and think, oh my goodness, I've got to get my act together here. And I would study really, really hard to make sure I pass my exams. So maths was very much a vehicle for me to be there in the end. I enjoyed it, but it was very hard, and I knew I was never going to be a mathematician.
So by the time you finished,
by the time I got to the end of the second year, I knew that's what I wanted. So, you know, I was applying for music college in the first term of the last year. You know, that's, I already knew that that's where I wanted to go. I think by the time I got to December, I knew I was going to the Royal Academy. I wanted to go originally as a conductor and a cellist, but they took me as a cellist, which actually ended up being a bit of a blessing, because I, you know, it's too young to be a conductor. And I think I needed to be better at what I wanted other people to be good at before I could.
But then presumably at some stage you must have sort of made conducting your main study or something. I don't know. I don't know how it works.
I did a 2-year cello course, you know, advanced studies or whatever it was called. Yeah. But actually, even in the first year, I didn't get in the conducting course. They only took 2 people a year. What typically one was a foreigner and one was an English person. So it wasn't like it was a devastating blow not to have got in, but obviously I wanted to do it. But then I applied in the first year of my cello course for the conducting thing. And I actually got to the final round, but somewhat stupidly, I got in the interview, they asked me, you know, how do you think the cello was going to fit in with the conducting? And rather than just saying, oh, well, of course, conducting is my first passion, I just was saying, well, you know, I don't know actually, because the cello's going quite well, and maybe I should get this right first and there. And I said all the wrong things, and I didn't get in. But I had a really good chat with the teacher afterwards, and he said, no, you know, we couldn't take you, could we? After what you said, that was silly. So then I applied again the next year, and
I think the words in the right place.
Well, the first question he asked me this time was, so do you actually want to do this course then or not? So that was, yes, and I got in, and we had 3 really great years with Colin Metters, a fantastic teacher.
Oh yeah.
Incidentally, and if you ever listen to this, he's a fantastic teacher, not because he could teach everything, it's because he knew what he couldn't teach. And I thought that was, and he almost said that often. You know, he didn't try to make us into him. He didn't try to give us his way of doing things. He just wanted us to be able to learn. That was his greatest gift, to be able to learn from others and to bring in other teachers who could give things that he wasn't able to do. And I thought that, but at the same time, he did give us a lot. There was no doubt about that. But just to, in some sense, a complete teacher without any ego. You know, he just wanted his pupils to do as well as they could.
That's really interesting. I mean, as you know, I've spent my professional life wondering about teachers and how they teach and why teachers are good and why they're not good and something like that. But I find what you just said really interests me. He knew what he couldn't teach, and that was part of his skill, it sounds to me.
Yeah, right? I mean, yeah.
So there you were at the Royal Academy studying. That's where you were, wasn't it? But then you went off to St. Petersburg. What's that all about?
I did, actually. Well, a reference to my answer, Colin being such a great teacher, is that he brought in my first year on the conducting course, he brought in this pedagogue from St. Petersburg, Ilya Musin, who was 89 at the time, had been teaching in the conservatory for 60-something years. Wow. It's a long story, but an incredible teacher, taught most of the great Russian conductors you can probably mention, you can name, but hadn't really been, only ever taught. He was a Jew. He was kind of kept down from the system and never... all his pupils were becoming great music directors of the big Russian orchestras, and his pupils were professors in other conservatories. And they didn't make him professor until he was, I don't know how old. It was, you know, one of those remarkable situations. But anyway, he came and gave some master classes, and we were just all blown away. When you asked me what conducting is about, you sat and watched this man and think, oh, okay, yeah, no, he's a really, he can, oh, wow, that's amazing. You know, he can do that, and he's not saying anything, and all sorts of things would come out. And so we had this great week. I'd been at the academy then for almost three years because of the cello, and I just felt a little bit of an itch. And I said to Colin, you know, I'd really like to go and study with him, but, you know, and he's 89, though. Who knows how long he's gone? I don't want to waste any time. So Colin was really gracious and said, why don't you just go and do 3 months with him? See if you can do that next year. So I did. So in the middle of my academy course, I went back and to Russia and had 3 months of, you know, incredible illumination, learned a lot about life. It was in 94.
And it was as good as you'd hoped.
He was amazing. Yeah. Yeah. He totally transformed me. Colin, the way he taught, his philosophy really was, you have to have a tree trunk. You can't have a tree without a trunk. Whatever comes above it, however beautiful, won't stand up. So you've got to get everything in fundamentally in order, which Colin did so well for me. And Musin was like, I know, to mix a few metaphors, it was like the icing on the cake. You know, it was the leaves, it was the fruit, all these amazing ideas that he could do things. And people would say to me while I was there, my God, you picked this up so quickly, what he's saying to you. And I knew, because I could do that because I had the fundamental already from Colin, and all these other people were trying to make, put the icing on, and they have the cake ready, you know. Wow. That makes sense.
And did you enjoy being in St. Petersburg, apart from the study?
A life-changing experience. Enjoyment is not really the right word. No, it was very tough, you know.
Yeah.
It was 94, perestroika just happened, and I would walk past pensioners on the street who were begging, and you know, these are pensioners who'd lived through the siege of Leningrad, and they were so desperately poor that they were begging. I mean, that was awful to look at, you know. And the place was a mess, and it was. And then there was two types of car. There was the Lada and the BMWs with the mafia, yeah. And it was the start of, you know, where we are in Russia now, the oligarchs and things like that. It was painful. It came back, I won't say depressed, but it was a completely different way of life.
It was a sort of eye-opener, in other words.
Yeah, totally eye-opener. And we're so glad I did it. I mean, obviously, you know, But enjoyment maybe wasn't. I
Yeah, right.
absolutely loved learning. Absolutely loved learning. We lived for the three lessons per week.
Royal Academy, St. Petersburg, you've finished your studies. How easy is it to transition from that into getting a job in your field?
You know, I must now I've reached a ripe old age of 54, and you know, people see me with a career. I'm often asked by conductors, you know, for help or for advice, and I'm really the worst person to ask because I was extremely fortunate that what happened in my career was it happened quite naturally, and I didn't plan it. It didn't happen the way I planned it, so I didn't do what everybody else thinks they need to do to get the job, if that makes sense. So I left college and I had no work. And I think I had, actually, that's not true. I had a tiny little amateur orchestra at Hounslow. And, but really not much to go on, but still had some cello playing that's trying to make ends meet. And it was the case then where I would just apply for any job, any job. It would be the Chipping Sodbury, you know, Sunday chorus or whatever. I didn't that they don't exist, but you know, anything like that, from to the Cambridge Phil to assistantships in the Northern Symphonia. I remember I applied for one, and then just got rejection letter after rejection letter, and it was just really tough, you know, because you knew you were good. I knew I was young, but I felt good enough to do it, you know. And so being a young conductor is really tough because you need so many people to give you the chance, you know. It's not like being an intern where you can just go and whatever. You go immediately to the head of the queue as a conductor. So people have to have a good reason to give you the work. And so it is hard. And I know a lot of people struggle getting their first chances. And I was incredibly lucky. I did start, I met one conductor who was very generous and gave me lots of rehearsals with his orchestras and kept me going, and it gave me a lot of confidence to go into places and, you know, not feel I was underprepared, or because I was underprepared, I just, you know, because I was doing a job for them. And so just doing it obviously was helpful. But then the big break kind of happened all at once when someone called me up wanting to go and study with my teacher from Russia. And in those days, it was very hard to get any information about it, let alone get in. And so I said, yeah, I'll have to talk to you about how to do it and whatever. And I had dinner with him, and he was a pianist at English National Ballet. And so we talked about how to go and study with Musin, and I just casually said, well, you know, any work at the ballet, you know, I'll do anything, you know. And he said, well, actually, we're advertising for an assistant conductor, so you should look out for it. It's going to be in the Telegraph this weekend. You should apply. So I did, and I didn't get the job. Interesting enough, I didn't even get called for an audition, and it was just one of many rejections. And then the Cambridge Philharmonic audition came, and then English National Ballet rang up again after that and said, "Oh, listen, are you still interested in the job? Because the person we hired didn't work out, didn't last long. So rather than, you know, if you're still interested, we'd like to audition you this time." So yeah, all these things started happening all at once. And so sure, you know, I knew nothing about ballet, and I went and played the piano pretty badly for the EMB, but somehow I got through to the audition round with the orchestra, and they gave me a show of Swan Lake. And at the same time, the audition with the Phil would come up. And I still remember the day of the Phil, thinking, okay, I have to do Dvořák 6. I don't know that. I'll have to learn that. Hebrides Overture, that's easy. I know that. I've got that. I got on the day, on the morning of the Phil audition, woke up, went to my bookshelf to find my score of Hebrides. Couldn't find it anywhere. So I was turning up to this audition with the Phil, you know, because by that stage I was busy, and I didn't, you know, it wasn't that I didn't care about the job, because I was actually really interested in the job, but I hadn't had time to prepare. But it also meant when I turned up to the audition, I was just quite relaxed because it was a bit of que sera, sera. I couldn't believe it. I got the Phil job, which was really fantastic. And then I got the EMB job, which was fantastic. So having had nothing, I then had, I'd say, one and a half jobs. The EMB job was definitely a full-time job, and the Cambridge Phil is, you know, it can be quite quite full of time. So that I was went from zero to at least 40 on the speed of things. So I was really lucky, and I never had to do anything else after that. So everything that I got after that was kind of because I was already doing stuff.
Now, look, I'm pretty certain I know, and that's partly because of the communication we had before we did this conversation and everything you've been involved in. You've been, it was the Christmas season, lots of Nutcracker. You had all these contemporary ballets you had to premiere and prepare mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And if on top of that, from what you said at the beginning of our conversation, you're sort of doing all the administrative work and you're auditioning new players and you're going to the board meetings of the ballet and stuff like that, that's a hell of a workload. It sounds to me like a really quite a tough workload. And of course, you have, you know, your own family commitments and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you're passionate about conducting. Everything you've said in this conversation is quite clear. How passionate you are about it, but presumably you need to sort of step off sometimes and get off the bus or whatever, the train or whatever it is. And I'm wondering, do you have anywhere or anywhere you go or anything you do? What do you do just to kind of completely divest yourself of any of the tension and the stress and all that kind of stuff?
So just to go back on that the beginning of the question, it's like, it is an extremely full schedule. I mean, so the San Francisco Ballet has a season that runs from December to May. So between December and May, I'm doing the full-time job of being a conductor plus the music director. And it does become extremely, extremely busy. But then the company doesn't perform very much as dancers between May and December. So there's still the administrative part of it. So I'm still gainfully employed, but nothing like the crazy schedule. So the summer months and the autumn allow me to have a little time for myself, which is more time for myself, which it sounds a bit cliche, but really the first thing I do is reconnect with my family, because it's, you know, it's every evening. So especially in the early days, I would drop my kids off at school. No matter what happened the night before, I would always make sure, if they've had a show till 11 o'clock, I'd get up and I would drive the kids to school, because it could conceivably be the only time I see them in the day. And so, and that would happen for days on days on end. So it's really important to spend the time with the kids. My daughter's really into ballet. Her mother's a ballet teacher, well, was a great dancer as well. Incidentally, the person who came to guest for English National Ballet, which is like another...
That is a good story.
Another sort of showing that life finds its way. And my son is, you know, he's a talented piano player, and he's a talented soccer player, football player, if you're in England. I say soccer now, it does. And so I spent a lot of time, you know, my son and I watch soccer on TV, and it's great because we can do that at 7 o'clock on a Saturday morning, have some good times together and relaxation before, and we can still have two shows in the day and still get things done. But what I do, I mean, I still passionately follow Bolton Wanderers, and I like cricket. We watch English cricket on TV here now. The internet's great; I get all their games, and I've always found a great satisfaction in cooking. That's my kind of. If I had loads of time and loads of money and I didn't care about buying ingredients that were going to go off and I could just experiment, that's what I would do.
Explain what you've just said about ingredients.
Well, I mean, the thing is, like, I've always, if you want to cook something, you have to have, I've always liked to experiment. I've always liked to sort of think, well, how does that go together? And, you know, what does butternut squash taste like if you grill it? What does it taste? You know, I don't know, but no one has the time, nor the energy, nor the money to go and buy 15 butternut squashes to go and see what the best way of preparing butternut squashes, and does it taste better with cinnamon or nutmeg, or, you know, and there's these great chefs, they do that, you know, they experiment. So when you go to Heston Blumenthal, you don't get something he's just created that day. He's been working on that for weeks and weeks and weeks. It's like a composition, you know, like a music composer, he spends ages refining it and getting every single aspect of it perfect before he then rolls it out. He can recreate it over and over again. And I love the idea of recreation. I love the idea of experimenting and trying things. I got into cooking because when I was gainfully unemployed in England, I used to watch Ready, Steady, Cook, and I used to love it. It was half an hour. People would bring £5 worth of ingredients, and the chef would have to make something up like that from there. And I love that idea because I still do that. Go to the fridge and say, "Oh God, we got these leftover whatnots, and we got to, what can I make out of it that's going to be good?" So I get enjoyment out of the therapeutic thing of just cooking, and even slicing and dicing vegetables is quite therapeutic.
Why, why is it therapeutic?
I don't know. It's just get all if you can get all the vegetables the right shape, and you get every ounce of meat off a bone, all these things. I don't know. I just find it. I just it's something to zone out, zone into. I don't mind cooking for lots of people. I did a for my wife's ballet school's fundraiser. I did a they asked me if I would do a dinner. There's like a celebrity dinner with a celebrity chef. And I said, of course, I said, yeah. And they wanted to charge some, what I thought was a ridiculous price. But they said, oh, we'll get that. I said, but okay, but so eight people, see, if you can get eight people to do that, that's fine. And then came at the end, I wasn't there, I had a show. And my wife came back and said, it was amazing. They sold 27. So I said, well, I can't do 27. And then, they got me help, but it was great. I loved it. It was for the day I was chef. And I got to cook some food, and
What did
they
you cook?
all, oh, well, I did a mixture of things. I was really scared because cooking for, so that many people and getting it all the right at the ready time. I had a, so
Says
there's a,
the man who regularly controls 70 people in the pit
no,
with
I know exactly. It's funny,
25.
isn't it? So I'm controlled there, but I'm not, once I'd done that, I realized I couldn't be a chef. But I did a 4-course meal. I tried to, I didn't make up anything. I just recreated things that I knew I could do, but and tried to come up with a thing that sort of fit together, and had a couple of guys help me, sous chefs, the host graciously got me. So, but it was fun. But it was a whole day. In fact, it took me 3 days because I prepared half of it in advance. And I thought, how can chefs do this? Really, because I served the same meal to 27 people, and it took me 3 days to make it. And how do these guys do it day in, day out, when there's a menu and you have to choose for between the fish and the steak? I mean, I just gave them all, braised pork, which was a piece of cake. And I was just so admire these guys, because it's the same thing. There's a reason why conductors are called chef d'orchestre in France, and there's a chef de cuisine. It's you're the chief. You have to coordinate. I think that's what, in that sense, the French means, the coordinator of everything. And these
But
guys.
you used the word you did use the word zone out earlier, and so what cooking allows you to do, presumably, is just to go
Yeah,
into
well,
that different world. And
yeah, no, I wasn't zoned out when I was doing it for a meal
for
for 27
27 people.
people. That wasn't zoning out. But just preparing the vegetables, just cutting the potatoes. So I kind of like it. It's nice. And I always do the Thanksgiving, cooking mostly at home. I do all the big meals usually.
This is a ridiculous question, but we're finishing up now. But it's a kind of a ridiculous question. If for some reason conducting was taken away from you, can you imagine yourself doing anything else?
Well, see, the one thing that did happen in the pandemic is that you were forced to do something other than conduct. So, and in some ways, I was forced to learn a new skill, which is sound editing. And I found a great interest in that, actually, since we've made recordings for the orchestra, and I've enjoyed making, putting, studio recordings together, and also live recordings for the orchestra. And it's terrible because a little knowledge is a terrible thing. And I'm completely self-taught. But I was trying to recreate an orchestral sound of a full orchestra with people recording with fire engines going outside on their iPhones, and so it was a and I was very lucky because we worked with a studio just north of here, Skywalker Studios, which is George Lucas's state-of-the-art studios, and we've done recordings there. And so I know the engineers there, and they were really kind and gave me really good information. And so, how do I solve this? How do I make this sound like that? And then you don't know what you're doing, because you just suddenly they say, well, you know, try putting a low shelf on that and taking the, you know, changing this reverb to that. And they didn't even know what I'd done, but they know, you know, and you put it and think, oh my God, that sounds so much better. So probably if I go blind, or I'm not blind, that's not the word, but if I want a hand chopped off or something, I can't conduct, it's really difficult for me to imagine myself not in music somehow. I know that's really narrow-minded, isn't it? I should be. You know what? I still love cosmology and I love quantum mechanics. For my days in doing maths, I still read about that. That's the other thing I kind of do to relax, is discover, you know, the latest stuff that's going on in the science world. I'm still fascinated by that.
Well, I don't think you are going to stop conducting anytime soon. Now, listen, Martin, you've been incredibly generous with your time. It's been an enormous pleasure to see you again, talk to you, and most especially for me, listen to you. I think I've learned more about sort of conducting and what that's all about in this conversation than I've ever understood before, and I've enjoyed every single second of it. But I'm going to take away with me a cooking cosmologist with sort of doing intricate maths in the background and all sorts of other things, and it's a wonderful image. I would like to say thank you very, very much for being so generous with your time. Thank you very, very much for this. Thank you, Martin. Join me next week when I talk to folk singer Pauline Valence, who talks very movingly about her career as a youth worker and what that means to her and for the youth she's involved with. And in the meantime, and with Martin West's permission, I'm going to leave you with a recording made in Ely Cathedral well over 20 years ago of him conducting the Cambridge Philharmonic Orchestra in Schubert's Unfinished Symphony. And it's not a professional recording, but I hope you enjoy it. See you the next time you come to my hinterland, what we do when we're not doing what we do.